Queen Mae Butters is a witness to those miracles all the time because of her job. Queen is a hospice nurse, meaning she cares for people at the end of their lives. She's found that dying isn't always bleak and sad and full of suffering. Because death is universal, it can be a time of unique and precious connection. Here's the story of one of those connections between Queen and Rose.
I called Rose on a Wednesday to introduce myself as her hospice nurse. This week, she had been diagnosed with liver cancer and declined any treatment options. Her doctor had referred her to our home hospice. Hi, Rose. My name is Queen Butters. I'm a nurse with home hospice. There is a long pause, some swallowing sounds, and then I hear her say, "Okay, listen, I'm new to dying. I've been getting a lot of calls today when I usually get none. Guess what else? Can you believe someone is trying to steal my identity at the same time I have cancer? I have to get used to all this. Who did you say you are? Some kind of butter?" No, my first name is actually Queen and my last name is Butters. I'm a registered nurse that comes to your home and visits you weekly. Rose says, "Well, isn't this a kick? I'm gonna die, someone wants my identity, and I have a nurse named Queen." Her apartment is on the sixth floor of a walk-up near Alphabet City, the Lower East Side of Manhattan. The first time I walk up her steps, I stop at the fourth floor, already planning to hand her care off to a nurse who is more spry, who can walk up those stairs weekly without complaining. Then I hear Rose's twangy New York accent encouraging me from above. "You're gonna make it, nurse. You're almost here. Keep climbing." Rose held out her arms to help me up the last few steps. Her abdomen was round as if it held a 6 month pregnancy, her skin yellowing like a peach. Rose grabs my hands, pulling me up the last few steps into her embrace. There she is, like some kind of old friend, holding me up with her yellow arms as I catch my breath enough to introduce myself. Her apartment is a two-room studio with a kitchen and a teeny tiny bathroom. Her bed is in the first room. There is a dining table serving as her desk and an office chair with a big computer her workplace had loaned her. She tells me the second room in her apartment is a closet and a guest area, adding, "But I don't have too many guests anymore." What I notice is the way her apartment is lit in the middle, holding the light like a temple. Rose collects broken glass, glass prisms, and broken shards of colored glass from the streets of the East Village. She collects glass she finds and glues it to her windows. These windows directly face the dirty bricks of the building next door. Sunlight coming through the old bottles and mashed ashtrays feels like stained glass windows on every wall. She sits on her bed. I sit on the office chair. I can see how tired she is. Her morning has been spent talking to detectives about her stolen identity and getting deliveries and visits from her new hospice team, which she had not understood to be a home service that comes to her, that she doesn't have to go anywhere. She has been a healthy, strong woman ascending six floors of stairs for 20 years in her cozy little East Village life. Despite the cancer and her swollen abdomen, she tells me, "I'm perfectly healthy." "I'm lucky," she announces, "because for the last 2 years, I've been following a practice where the day I'm in is my last one. Like the Buddhists say, I'm ready," she says. "I just don't know how it's gonna go down. That's where I need help." She points to her abdomen with her thin little arms. The doctor had told her if she took chemo and radiation, she would live 2 to 3 months longer than if she was just to let the disease run its course. She said, "I've lived over 50 years. I've been happy. I'm just gonna have to see what happens, like I've always done." I visit Rose weekly, adjusting her medications so she is comfortable, safe, and pooping. We start Rose on oral steroids to help increase her energy and appetite. She says to me one visit, Queen, I know what those pills you are that you got me. They are drugs, plain and simple, like the speed and ecstasy we used to take at the bars. I can feel how it speeds up my mind and makes me think I'm right about everything. Rose has spent the better part of her time in the East Village as a barfly. She had lost her taste for vodka and whiskey by the time I met her, but she told me stories of friendships that came and went depending on where she was drinking. Years ago, Rose drank with a gay man from Brazil who needed citizenship. Long before the Immigration Service caught on to fake marriages for green cards, she married him for convenience and money. He got his green card, she got $5,000. Their friendship ended, she said, because they had had a fight. Rose says, can't remember what the fight was about. I'm not good at fixing things after I get mad. Her ex-husband had heard that Rose had fallen ill. He called her up. Neither one could remember why they fought or why they stopped being friends. He told her he left the bars to study Zen Buddhism with a Zen Sangha in the Soho. He asked Rose if his teacher could come and visit. He said, maybe you would want to learn some meditation that might help you with your death. Rose tells me, I have always tried everything, so why stop now? The Zen teacher came wearing a black robe and thick, heavy leather shoes. He changed out of the shoes for black socks with a space sewn in just for his big toe. He taught Rose to sit through her fear and stay calm. They would end the meditation, ring the bell, and then both would light up cigarettes. I trusted him immediately when I saw his pack of camels, Rose said. The Zen teacher enjoyed Rose and visited often to teach, meditate, and smoke with her in her sixth-floor walk-up. A room at the hospice residence opened just as Rose was declining and falling asleep with lit cigarettes in her bed. Rose had her friends nail her paintings up on the walls of her room at the hospice and replace the table lamps with her own lamps. She lived a few weeks at the inpatient hospice, her body becoming heavier with fluids. She stopped being able to eat and eventually drink. I sat with Rose the evening before the morning of her death. It was pitch black outside. There was a thunder and lightning storm. Rose's room had a killer view of the East River and beyond. She is on her side, facing away from the window, facing towards me. I am sitting next to her, my hand on her body, feeling her breathe move through her, watching the sky pop with light after every thunder crash. Rose had been quiet after kissing my hand when I arrived. Her eyes are closed and she is not talking. One thunder crash arouses her and she says, Queen, I don't want to die. Is this dying? I'm not ready. I have so much more. Her voice drifts off. I'm always at a loss at what to say in these instances because I do not know what is comforting. I close my eyes and I see Rose standing at the top of her steps, peering down at me that first day we met, encouraging me to make it all the way up. I remember all the mischief and beauty she had created in her apartment and in the little Manhattan village that was her place. Rose, do what you have always done. Gather your resources and go forward. I love you no matter what you do. I love you, Rose. She squeezes my hand and goes back to the quiet place. I left her side when the Zen teacher arrived around 11 p.m., both of us loyal stewards to a woman we met mere months before. He sits with her all night, meditating, tells her he wants to be awake with her when she dies. They were together. She died in the early morning when the sun was just beginning to shine over her East Village. Thank you.
Thank you, Queen.